Welcome back, everybody, to the Talking Sportsbooks podcast. And coming up in this final edition of 2023, I'm joined by John Preston, author of the just-released book Watford Forever, which tells the story not only of Watford's incredible rise from teetering on the brink of bankruptcy all the way to Division One and FA Cup final at European football, and on a budget of under £1 million, but also the story of how Elton John first became a Watford fan, then owner chairman, and the emergence of Graham Taylor and the bond between the two of them. But before we get there, something to look out for as we pass the 50th edition of this programme. We're going to be going back over the coming months through all of the previous editions to pick out some of the most memorable moments from some of the stories we've told with the authors that we've spoke to. So you'll see 5, 6, 7 minute clips appearing across the social media spectrum and on the website over the coming months. Now, if you missed the most recent edition of the show, which is currently on the website, Gary Newbon recants memories of his 50 years as a broadcaster primarily with ITV. And there are many, many amusing anecdotes. And a great many of you, in fact, more pretty much than any other episode of this podcast down the years, have commented in particular on the memories of Brian Clough. So for those of you who've not heard it, here's a clip from the show with Gary Newbon remembering the moment that Brian Clough kissed him live on ITV. I'm just trying to imagine you standing there when one of the most famous faces in football just leans over across and just kisses you. I mean,
I was shocked. And actually, I've got to be honest, I didn't handle it very well. And there's a shot of me bouncing all over the place. What had happened, actually, basically, I'll keep it short, was that we only had 30 seconds for the... It was a midweek match, and it was just before Nottingham Forest were playing at Wembley in the League Cup final. It was a midweek match, and I only had 30 seconds because we're going into news at 10. And they said, you've got to stick with it. And Clough had promised me an interview, whatever the result. So he comes bounding off. They've lost heavily, and they've played awful. They were awful. And he still gave me the interview. And I started off by saying, you know, trying to make it easy for him because I didn't want to stuff him. He'd given me the interview, and they'd lost and played badly. I said, was that down to the fact that you're soon going to be playing at Wembley? And Cluffy said, no, only Albert is short of his place on the coach to Wembley. And I got annoyed. I thought, they haven't got an Albert, you know, doing my homework. I said, you haven't got an Albert. He said, yes, we have. He's the driver. Oh, I thought, oh, no. So I got a bit annoyed, a bit unprofessional. I pushed him a bit too hard. And I overran, which is the worst thing you could do. I started to ask another question. And the floor manager, Trevor East, the head of ITV Sport, who's a great colleague of mine, he's going potty at me in my earpiece. And Stan Harding, the floor manager's going potty, and Cluffy can see him. And he understood television, Cluffy. So he grabbed me and he said, why are we so bad? Because we're a bunch of pansies like you and me, and gave me this huge kiss. Well, I mean, it was unbelievable. And the sports editors were watching the programme because it was live in London. They got their reporters to come around. Was he drunk? and I said, no, he loves me. It's the only thing I could think of. But actually, I'm told that Northern comedians started telling much more vulgar jokes about a kiss, speculating where his tongue went and all sorts of things I better not go into on a nice programme like this.
Things that are like agents, which didn't really exist at that time. And you had stories of Cluffy. This was in particular about signing Roy McFarland, who Liverpool wanted at the time.
Yes.
And he and Peter Taylor just rock up at his house at 11:30 at night. I mean, the state of confusion. McFarland was in bed, and he's just like, well, we're here to sign you.
Yes, I mean, I think it might have even been later than that, but it doesn't matter. It's late, and McFarland's played. It was a Friday, and he's gone up to bed. He's in his pyjamas. The front doorbell goes. His parents answer it in their dressing gowns, and there's Clough and Taylor. They'd done the deal with Tranmere. Now they had to persuade the player to sign. So Roy McFarland comes down, these two gentlemen, to see you, and they start talking to him. And he's not sure, and he turns to his father, and his father says, listen, if they want you that badly, sign it. So he's about to sign it, and then he thinks, now, I'm going to Liverpool tomorrow. I know that Shankly wants me. I'm going to watch the match with my mate. I'll try and stall it. And Taylor slides the contract under his nose, McFarlane's nose, and says, listen to your dad. You got to sign now. We can't wait till tomorrow. So he signs. And then he goes to Liverpool the next day, and they win 5-0. And he thinks, what have I done? You know, what have I done? Anyway, he said what he did changed his life and his career, because they started winning big time, and he played for England. So it was a great move for McFarlane, who I'm still in touch with. He's an ambassador at Derby County. And then he wanted to sign Archie Gemmell from Preston, so he slept on the Gemmell family sofa all night until Gemmell signed the next morning. I mean, amazing. Cough could not have coped with agents. There was one agent who just looks after Gary Lineker and a few of the great broadcasters.
Yeah, now, yeah, I know.
Called John Holmes, a lifelong friend of mine. I used to do my finances, actually, before he became an agent. He took McAllister, Gary McAllister, to meet Clough with a view to signing, and Clough behaved so badly that Holmes and McAllister just walked out and never signed for him. But he wouldn't have been able to cope with agents.
Gary Newbon remembering the legendary Brian Clough. Doesn't matter, I don't think, who you support. Judging from the number of comments that have been made over the last month, everybody really had a respect for the legendary Brian Clough. There are many more of those Clough tales, by the way, in that episode, which is currently streaming on every major platform and on the website, www.talkingsportsbooks.com. Just time to mention our sponsors, primepodcast.co.uk, who produce, present, host, market, and generally do everything that you can think of relating to podcasts and podcasting and production, etc. So if you are thinking of producing your very own and want some advice, some highly cost-effective advice about how to start, where to go, the equipment, the marketing, the production, anything, then do get in touch. You can find them at www.primepodcast.co.uk. And so, as we enter that time of year where we like nothing better than an uplifting story, a fairy tale, a fantasy, a Cinderella story, perhaps, something that leaves you with that warm glow inside. So here it is, one of football's greatest tales. It's written by John Preston in collaboration with Elton John, and it is called Watford Forever. Now, this isn't a story just for Watford fans. It's a story for every football fan of a team, perhaps, that is known by an oligarch or a government or a country, that just has this dream that one day they will have their moment, no matter how brief, where they can wallow in a season in the Premier League or maybe make a cup final, maybe make European competition. This is a story not only about football, but relationships, friendships, the creation of a bond between two people that was built on trust and respect. Now, it is only supposed to go on for about 25, 30 minutes or so, but you know what it's like. There are so many twists and turns, so many great moments in this story that, well, you know, it's like that Pringles advert, isn't it? Once you pop, you can't stop. So once we just started talking, it sort of went on a bit. So sit back and enjoy it. I hope you like it. The book is Watford Forever. The author is John Preston. And here he is talking about it. I want to say that this book is certainly not just for Watford fans. This is a football fairy tale, a Cinderella story, and not just about a football club. It's about relationships and friendships. I mean, it's almost like Love Actually of football.
Well, that's very kind of
you.
yeah, that's true. I mean, there are various reasons for that. One of which I'm a bit kind of ashamed to admit, is that I've never been, I've been always been a bit more of a Spurs fan than a Watford fan, which I realize is kind of terrible heresy in Watford. But I did, I remember when I first had a meeting with David Furnish to talk about the book, and I kind of proposed the idea. And we'd had this very good meeting. And I did, I sort of felt, honor bound to tell him at the end of it that, I wasn't a kind of lifelong Watford supporter or anything like that. And he just went, oh, I don't think we should worry too much about that. I'd always kind of conceived it from the word go as being, as you say, it's a story about a friendship between Elton and Graham Taylor. And it's about what they achieved at Watford. And also there was another kind of important strand to it, as far as I was concerned, which was what effect the success of the team had on the town. Because Graham Taylor, who had previously been at Lincoln City before he went to Watford, had kind of really pioneered this idea that a football club should be an integral part of the community. And he insisted that all the players should live within a 10-mile radius of the ground. And it was written into their contracts that they had to visit hospitals and schools. But the whole kind of ethos of it was to instill in the footballers that they were no better than their supporters. And, woe betide anybody who got uppity, because if they did think that, he'd kick them straight out.
When we're talking about a club that was down on its uppers, they weren't just down on their uppers. I mean, this story begins in 75. They're relegated to Division 4. You've got a chairman, Mike Keane, who's promising no stone will be left unturned. And then they lose to Weymouth. They're off to Darlington. The club's doctors have resigned because they haven't been paid for months. The players have to go to a local doctor's surgery.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally laughable. You've got Ross Jenkins being hailed as this great new beginning of a fabulous football player and then being told he's the worst signing ever. And on that day, Darlington, I think it was, there's a young kid called Luther Blissett. So that is where we start.
Yeah. Well, we start at the bottom with Watford in 92nd place in the Football League. And there were then, as there are now, 92 clubs in the Football League. So they were as low as they could possibly go. And Elton had taken them over, but he didn't have, I mean, he knew things had to change radically when he did take them over. And of course, he was the first pop star to own a football club, which was taken in quite a lot of quarters, actually, as yet another sign that their country was going to the dogs. And he was very canny. And although he'd never done anything like this before, he never chaired a board meeting or anything like that, he was kind of uncowed by the idea of running Watford.
But what you do well in this book, can I just say, is you even get there. We've started with seeing where Watford were in terms of the league and their debts and everything else. And then you get back to finding out, I mean, unless you've read Elton's biography, autobiography, you won't know anything about this, about how he became a Watford fan back in 1953 when he was six years old. Old Reggie Dwight from Pinner, who goes with his father for the first time ever to a Watford game. And that is it. And that is where the love begins. The obsession for him begins.
Yep, absolutely. It seemed to me, kind of from the word go, that this story had to be rooted in Elton's childhood.
Yeah.
Because as you say, he was 6 years old when his father first took him to see Watford. And this thing really that had never happened before happened when they were on the way to the first game, which is his father, they were surrounded by supporters, and his father reached down and held his hand. And his father, Stanley, was a very kind of emotionally undemonstrative man. And yet when they got to the ground, to Elton's astonishment, You know, his father started whooping and hollering and cheering along with everybody else. And he saw this kind of side of his father that he'd never seen. And then when they got home again, you know, normal home life resumed and this kind of emotional shutter came down. And I think it was incredibly confusing for Elton, or Reggie as he then was. And I think it was at those moments, and only at those moments, that he felt that he was the son that his father wanted. So it was an enormously potent kind of emotional tie in his life.
Most of the other time you were talking about, we were discussing Elton growing up in his house, the parents are constantly rowing and arguing and everything else.
Yeah,
and it's he who believes that he's the problem. And
he's an only child, you know, not much self-confidence. He's shy. And he has this absolute conviction that if he wasn't around, his parents would be getting on fine.
And then you've got Graham Taylor, because we've begun with Elton. We've seen where Watford are, and then we see where Graham is living in a prefab in Scunthorpe. His dad's a sports writer. And these are just other great stories. As a kid, his dad would take him into the press box and he'd sit there with his little pen and paper and he'd be making notes and he'd be called upon. And it was a completely different upbringing for him.
Yes, it was, in the sense that he came from a, you know, secure and loving family. And yet, although, you know, they were as kind of diametrically opposed as it's possible for two people to be, you know, there are certain similarities there. They were both grammar school boys from lower middle class backgrounds. They were roughly the same age. They obviously shared the same obsession with football. And so, you know, yes, there are a hell of a lot of differences between them, but there were these kind of, you know, as it were, sort of subterranean network of similarities as well.
Absolutely. And he mentioned that he was a highly competitive child. I love that. Yeah. He says he's 13 years of age and he asked Rita Cowling out and she was 16. Now, I can't imagine being a 13-year-old.
Nor can I.
Having the nerve to go up to a 16-year-old.
Exactly.
That with me.
Yeah. No. I mean, and he had, I think that he had this kind of, you know, he was a natural leader. And he had a kind of enduring faith in his own abilities. You know, certainly his self-confidence was rattled badly from time to time. But I think that his parents had kind of instilled this idea in him, which is basically whatever you do in life, be a participant and not an onlooker. And I think that had an enormous effect on him, and it stayed with him really throughout.
And how times change. Can you imagine going into your headmaster's office and you have a modicum of talent and saying, well, yes, I'm actually going to become a professional footballer? The school would be putting it up in lights. They'd be following your career. There would be social media posts. As for Graham, he was told he'd be a disgrace to the school and bring shame on his family.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you've got to remember how, what a kind of weird social category footballers were in.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they were sort of, they existed kind of beyond the pale. And, you know, just on sort of purely practical things, like, you know, they couldn't get mortgages or anything because they were earning so little money. They had they had no job prospects at all post their playing careers. And, you know, building societies just wouldn't give them mortgages. So, I mean, you know, they lived in this kind of weird, kind of like a sort of half world where they were sort of famous, but also broke.
Yeah. Absolutely. And meanwhile, back at Reggie's, you know, the volcanic arguments are going on. But there was his light bulb moment came when both his parents very musically orientated, a copy of Heartbreak Hotel arrives in the household, and that's it, isn't it? That's the moment when he realizes, for me, it's going to be something to do with music. I want to entertain.
Yes, that and something that happened quite soon afterwards, I think, that his parents, you know, as you said, music was kind of about the only thing they did have in common. They didn't argue about, although they had very different tastes. But they would go and see pub entertainment, entertainers. And I remember when I was talking to Elton for the book, he'd gone to see some guy in a pub. I can't remember where it was, Uxbridge, I think. And yeah, this guy said he completely got the audience in the palm of his hand. And that also made a huge impression on Elton. And I remember him saying to me, you know, basically, I'm like a pub entertainer, but, you know, except I play in stadiums and everything like this. And in a funny kind of way, I knew what he meant, because, you know, he is absolutely brilliant at getting the audience on his side. And if you try and analyze how he does it, you can't. I mean, it just sort of defies analysis, and yet it's plainly there.
Graham's left school and he's gone off to join Grimsby Townsend Apprentice, as they did back then. And again, this gives you an insight into the character. The first thing that shocked him more than anything else was the language in the dressing room. More than anything else, it's just the fact that they literally swear like troopers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he'd come from quite a kind of cloistered upbringing in a way. And it was, you know, I think it was quite prim and proper. And so that did come as a shock. But at the same time, he knew that he had to, and he knew this sort of instantaneously as well, that he had to adapt if he was going to get ahead. And, you know, he couldn't walk around with his kind of nose metaphorically stuck in the air, as it were. You know, he had to be one of the boys. And he, you know, he got ahead. And he very quickly proved himself.
Yeah. He signed on for 12 quid a week for 3 years at Grimsby. Yeah. And let's not forget, it gets reduced in the summer, a tenner. But when he left Scunthorpe for Lincoln, and again, something that people may not know, he'd already qualified as an FA coach, the youngest to ever do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was a canny young man, and he'd really worked out that you needed a second string to your bow as a footballer in case anything went wrong. So, as you say, he qualified and he'd become very, very interested in, as it were, the science of playing football and tactics. And even then was sort of interested in statistics, which was unheard of, really. I mean, no one in that era paid any attention to statistics. Well, they weren't accumulating statistics for a start. But he kind of reckoned that, you know, he became fascinated with the idea that it would be possible to teach a team of kind of comparative journeymen, if you taught them properly, that they would be able to beat another team of more talented people. So that was a real, you know, it was a challenge for him. It was something he used to lie awake at night and kind of, you know, not exactly agonize about. But, you know, he would constantly play it and play it and play it in his head. And so in many respects, you know, years later, when he came to Watford, he was putting into practice a blueprint that he devised all those years earlier.
And the book that had the big impact on him was written by a guy called Arthur Hopcroft. The Way We Play the Game and organize it reflects the kind of community that we are. The book was called The Football Man, wasn't it? This had a big effect on him and how he organized things. Because let's not forget, during the time that we're talking about this, he has actually ticked another box because he has gotten married and he now has children.
Yes.
So he's going through life and he's ticking things off.
Yeah, and I mean, this was such a kind of central thing for Graham about community, and you know, I mean, I know we've talked a bit about it before, but it's impossible to overemphasize what a weird idea that was at the time, where, because, you know, even though footballers didn't, it's not as if they existed on the kind of, you know, different planet to everyone else that they do now, but they were still kind of, you know, different people. And the notion that they weren't different people and that they had to behave like everyone else, that was, you know, it was just deemed to be really, yeah, very, very eccentric.
His parents divorced, Elton's parents divorced.
Yes.
And she married again. The relationship he had with his stepfather seemed to be a lot more creative, in terms of there was a lot more input from his stepfather. For example, his stepfather encouraged him to entertain, to get his first gig up and going. I think it was, he picked up 10 quid, didn't he, from the Pass the Hat Around.
Yeah.
At the Northwood Hills hotel. But even after his father left the house, he still continued to go to watch Watford, and he stood in exactly the same place.
Yeah, absolutely. And it had become this great ritual for him. And he would carry on doing it, and he would carry on doing it. Way beyond the point where his father, when his father remarried, moved quite a long way away from Watford. So, and they more or less lost all touch. And his father never, ever said to him, even when he became famous, you know, well done, you've done fantastically well.
Is that not something of the times? I mean, if you go back and look at your parents,
I think there was, I mean, oddly enough, I come from, you know, not entirely dissimilar background. My father was in the Navy, and he was probably as buttoned up emotionally as Elton's father. And I don't remember him ever saying, you know, well done or anything. I remember, you know, being ticked off a lot, but that was, yeah, so you're right. But I think that, and I was an only child as well, but I think that, you know, Elton always craved his father's approval, and he never got it, even when he became a kind of global superstar. And in a funny sort of way, although they were the same, he and Graham were pretty much the same age, it was much more like a kind of quasi-father-son relationship, with Graham as the father and Elton as the son. And because Elton really craved Graham's approval, and he got it, and he, you know, but he had to work for it. So yes, you're right that, you know, it was a sign of the times in a way, but I can't believe that, you know, there weren't fathers in the 50s,
yeah,
who didn't, you know, put their arms around their children, tell them they loved them, and, you know, say well done every so often.
Graham Taylor's 28 years of age, youngest manager in football. And this is where you start to see his blueprint as a manager. He's looking to create teams who score goals and attack. But then there's the community thing, the players going into the community so people could see how the club was representing them, because he felt they were representing them. Didn't like the word fans, did he? Because he didn't feel that actually recognised what they really were, which was supporters.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Lincoln was spoilt for choice. Yeah. So, you know, I think they probably thought, well, we might as well take a punt on him. He's young, he's going to be cheap. So, you know, and he was obviously bright, and he was very ambitious, and he very much impressed the board of directors when they kind of hauled him in for an interview. And you know, he did have this ability to be able to inspire people.
Elton, I never set out to be a star. I only really wanted to write songs. Ooh. 1965. It's incredible, isn't it, to think that he was writing then, and that single, that song rather, Comeback Baby. And then he joins Long John Baldry's backing band. So his musical career was setting off at a real pace.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Long John Baldry, who was very, very weird, because he was quite a sort of hard-bitten blues man. And this was a time when, you know, there were a lot of kind of British people playing R&B, like the Stones and so on and so forth. But he also was very, very camp, and he would play these he would sort of alternate his blues numbers with these astonishingly soupy ballads. And Elton played piano for him and liked him very much. And then, you know, the fateful day comes when he meets Bernie Taupin, who also incidentally, like Graham Taylor, was from Lincolnshire. And they have this kind of almost mystical connection. And he, as it were, turns from Reggie Dwight into Elton John.
This was something else that I didn't know, by the way, how the name came into being. Elton was after his ex-band sax player, and John was from Long John Baldry. That was it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he became, and then he added the Hercules later, which I think was not had less to do with the Greek god than the fact that in the TV sitcom Steptoe and Son about two rag and bone men, their horse was called Hercules.
Hercules, yeah.
And then he was kind of, you know, the what I hadn't realized properly before I started writing the book was that once Elton became Elton, as it were, he became famous very, very quickly. And his life changed really out of all recognition over the space of 2 years. Mm. And he, as you say, you know, he didn't set out to be famous. And there was a part of him that, you know, not surprisingly, loved being famous, and he loved the recognition, and, you know, he loved the money, he was able to buy his mum a car. But it wasn't long before he came to see that, you know, fame came with a lot of kind of pitfalls attached. And that's, I think, was really one of the reasons why he wanted to buy Watford. Because it was a link back to his childhood. It was a link back to being Reggie Dwight again.
When he made that change into being Elton John.
Yeah.
So this is the creation of the other him. So he's able to compartmentalize. Now, gone is the shy introvert. Mm. And this person, Elton John, is outrageously extrovert. So it was like, yeah, on a different skin. Or
yeah,
watching.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I remember him saying that when he played his first ever gig at the Northwood Hills Hotel, and, you know, he's pounding away on the piano in front of, you know, a bunch of pretty morose drinkers, and he has to try and win them round. And it just kind of came to him like a kind of lightning bolt, really. You know, I can do this, I'm good at it, and I enjoy it, and I can leave my old kind of shy self behind for as long as I'm singing. Then you know, as soon as I stop singing, I'll go back to being shy Reggie Dwight again. But it was, yeah, you're right. I mean, it was like a kind of new, it was a completely new identity that he was able to put on. But, you know, like all these things, to some extent, it was only a mask. And I think, you know, he's a highly, highly intelligent man. And you know, he was more aware, perhaps, than most people of the kind of gap between one identity and the other.
Graham's career, as we're, you know, roaring through the book and their lives, Graham lost his first game in charge, didn't win any of the next 10. I think the players at the time were very surprised about his disciplinarian managerial style. You know, his tactics were simple, weren't they? Attack, and then more attack, and then even more attack. And then the players are complaining about that they're being worked too hard. So he takes them to a factory to see how they get on, watching people on a 9-to-5 assembly line.
Yeah, I mean, but again, to kind of, you know, instill in them the idea that however hard his regime may have been at Lincoln, you know, they were the lucky ones. You know, they weren't kind of, I don't know, manufacturing rivets or whatever these people were doing. They were doing, in theory at least, what they loved for a living. And you're right, he was a really stern disciplinarian with this tremendous kind of work ethic. And that's another thing actually he had in common with Elton. You know, Elton was a hard worker. And he drove himself really hard. And the idea that people had that you sort of floated upwards if you were lucky and became a, you know, internationally famous rock star. You know, as he always said, you know, he had to work bloody hard at it. And I think that, you know, Graham had to work hard. And he knew that... If the bunch of people that he was in charge of at Lincoln, that they may not be that talented, but the very least they could be was fitter than everybody else.
August 1970 is a pivotal moment in this story because Elton's been, you know, writing and selling albums. Your song was written in 1969. His albums are getting recommendations in NME and Melody Maker, which is big news at the time. But it's the six nights of the Troubadour where he enters the stage in those yellow dungarees and the yellow boots. And that is the moment that he goes from being, Elton from Watford and doing gigs around the UK to becoming, you know, this is the beginning of the road to international superstardom here.
Yeah. And basically by the end of, I mean, those initial dates at the Troubadour, as far as I remember, were the start of what was supposed to be a rather kind of gentle introduction to America and, the hope that some few people would come and see him. And essentially by the end of that tour, he was being hailed as the biggest thing to hit America since the Beatles.
Yeah.
And he never looked back.
It's incredible. Watford had spent big money. Ross Jenkins. Who doesn't remember Ross Jenkins, 6'3" tall? Began, trained with Arsenal, didn't he, with the juniors? And this was a thing that stuck out for me. Shortly after his 18th birthday, he married one of his teachers.
Yes. I mean, she wasn't that much older than him. And I have to say, they've been very, very happily married ever since. I mean, I don't know how much older she is than Ross, but in a funny sort of way, you know, in the same way that Graham invited Rita out when, you know, never mind the 3-year age gap between them when he was 13, she was 16. You know, Ross had that a similar degree of self-confidence. At least he did until he went to Watford, where it was pretty quickly knocked out of him, because he went as the, you know, they, as you say, they'd spent more money on him than anyone else. He was supposed to be the guy who was going to lead Watford back to, well, actually, when I say lead them back, because they'd hardly ever been there, but, you know, he was going to lead them to glory and all the rest of it. And he very rapidly, you know, the Watford faithful lost all faith in him, and they used to say that he couldn't trap a bag of wet cement if it landed at his feet, and that he could be outjumped by any one of Snow White's seven dwarves. And then he'd fall over his legs, and he was like this kind of ungainly giraffe. And, you know, he was somebody whose confidence really couldn't have got any lower. And he was, I can't remember how old Ross was. He was something like 27, possibly even 28, I think, when Graham Taylor took over at Watford. So he was absolutely in the kind of last chance saloon, as were a lot of the players. And you know, yeah, he kind of, he became one of the four rocket men, as they were dubbed, who went all the way from the bottom of the fourth division, as it then was, to the top of the first division, which is probably the most amazing thing of all about Graham Taylor's time as manager of Watford. Because it always used to, I mean, one of the things that's always really annoyed Elton was that people have assumed that Graham effectively bought a team with Elton's money. And as Elton has always said, you just can't do that. You know, it just never really works. You know, to me, the most extraordinary thing that Graham did was to get these four people who'd been written off as kind of no-hopers or has-beens. There was Ross Jenkins, Luther Blissett, Steve Sherwood, and Ian Bolton. And I remember Ian Bolton, you know, it was a brilliant midfield player who was sort of like Watford's version of Glenn Hoddle, but that's a kind of oversimplification. I just remember Ian was one of the first people I interviewed for the book. And he said this thing that really stuck with me, which was that, you know, Graham made us exceed our own expectations of ourselves. What? That, you know, these were people who thought that they were really not that good at all. And Graham said, no, you're better than that, and I'm going to help you realize it. And he did. And that's a very, very rare thing in life.
It is. The other major surprise here for me is as you're looking at this success that's coming Elton's way, you know, he's got his own 747 for transport, 707 for transport. Again, he is the hottest thing in the US. He is still obsessed with Watford, and it's a night when he's out with John Reid, his manager, and I think it was Vic Lewis, wasn't it, his agent.
Yeah.
He sits down and says to him, right, I want to be on Watford's board. I've got no idea how to do it, but that's what I want.
I think there was a real, I think the connection that he had with Watford fulfilled what at the time was actually an increasingly desperate emotional need, which is, you know, he'd become extraordinarily famous, and part of him loved it, but part of him, you know, craved a degree of normality. And as we talked about before, you know, he wanted a link back to his childhood. He wanted a link back to being Reggie Dwight. And when he was a child, his bedroom was his kind of sanctuary, where he could go and you know, gaze at his Watford programs and everything like that.
And it everything was really organised.
Yeah, everything was organised. Everything was in its proper place. And it was the one place in the world where he could go and feel safe. And Vicarage Road fulfilled the same function when he became an international superstar, because he could go there, no one would make a big fuss about over him. And he said that he was basically happier in the supporters club at Vicarage Road than he was in his own home. And so, you know, he needed it to kind of to anchor him to reality in some way.
You've got some great quotes. And the day he goes to meet Jim Bonser, the current man in charge there, he said, he's going into the boardroom at Watford. He said, it was extraordinary for me. It was like a religious experience. But he did it not as Reggie, but as Elton, because he arrived in 8-inch platforms with green hair. And I think I called him Sir.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's a photograph in the book of the Watford's board of directors. And, you know, there's Elton. And then there are these men who look kind of like sort of grey donuts in suits sitting around a boardroom table. But actually, you know, although he was a kind of creature from another planet as far as they were concerned, I think by this point they recognized that having a very rich rock star as their chairman might, you know, have come with certain advantages attached. So they were perfectly sort of courteous and welcoming to him.
But he did get a free ticket and unlimited gold buffet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they didn't know what to make of him. But he was kind of, you know, he was discreet, as it were. He didn't try to impose himself. He listened and just felt that, you know, here I am, I got a lot to learn. And so by the time he appointed Graham as manager, he had sort of properly got his feet under the table and he knew what he was talking about. And he would, you know, he would take, although he'd never chaired a board meeting before in his life, he would take it very seriously. And they would have these kind of long, pretty laborious discussions about the state of the guttering at, you know, Vicarage Road and other, you know, numbingly dull subjects. But he would make sure that he'd read up about them and, you know, he really knew his stuff.
When he bought the club in 76, it was 200 grand, wasn't it? Which was him clearing the debt. And again, that's one of his quotes. I didn't need to think twice. He was straight in there. But he told the board on day one, and I'm just trying to imagine as they're sat there and he swings into the room, right, I'm going to take you, or I want to take them, to the first division. I mean, it's hard to imagine how ludicrous that would have been to hear it.
It was plainly nuts, but it was sort of inspiring nuts, I think. Given the fact that, you know, Watford had, you know, not been a club sort of in, you know, where ambition had counted for very much, to have this kind of, you know, extraordinary creature comes in and say, right, you know, we're going to go to the top. And, you know, they plainly thought it was sort of rock star derangement and all the rest of it. But I think there was a part of them that thought, well, you know, okay, let him prove himself and let's see how far we get.
Acceptance of sexuality, I mean, LGBTQ, etc. these days, I mean, there is a level of acceptance now. I mean, it's taken for granted for the majority. Yeah. Back then, it was very, very different. But that interview with Rolling Stone, which they broached the subject of being bisexual, and he said, listen, there's nothing wrong with going to bed with somebody of your own sex. Everybody is bisexual to a degree. I mean, this was huge. But the reaction from the then manager, Mike Keane, was... perhaps people wouldn't have expected it, because he literally called him in and they just said, listen, we don't care what it says. You're our chairman and we love you.
I mean, absolutely.
How good would that have made Elton feel?
I think it made him feel very good, except that there was a part of him that knew that Mike Keane was going to have to be sacked sooner or later. So, I mean, I think he felt very grateful. But on the other hand, he knew that he couldn't just stay purely grateful for long.
Yeah, yeah. Elton tried to get Graham and didn't. And then he phoned and offered him huge money, didn't he? 20 grand a year for being for a club in Division 4. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm not interested. I'll get back to you again, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, he did. And then he was all set to go to...
West Brom?
Was it West Brom,
yeah,
sorry.
Militia.
That's right. He was all set to go to West Brom, who were in the first division, and they were going places and all the rest of it. And then Bert Millichip, who was the chairman of West Brom, was very, very kind of patronising to Graham, which always kind of, you know, put his hackles up, and assumed that having had this offer from West Brom, Graham wasn't going to entertain another offer from anyone else. And Graham, who was very honourable, said, well, I've got it. Yeah, I feel I should tell you I've had an offer from somewhere else. And Millichip went, oh, yeah, where? And Graham went, Watford. And, you know, Millichip virtually fell off his chair and said, Watford, Watford? You can't seriously, you know, think of going to a bunch of losers like that. And in a funny sort of way, that sort of half made up Graham's mind. And this was before he'd even met Elton. He'd been to see Vicarage Road, the ground, which was even worse than he'd anticipated. And yet, you know, and then the next day he and Rita, his wife, went off and they met Elton.
At his home. I mean, I can only imagine the mansion in Windsor, but there was an immediate chemistry there. But again, I'm thinking, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall at the meeting. So, you know, what do you want to achieve? Well, I've told the directors, we want to get into Division One. What about you? Oh, well, I want to get into Europe. Graham Taylor's like, oh, I thought he was completely crazy. How much do you think it'll cost? Well, maybe about $1 million. Right, let's give it a go.
Yeah.
What a great meeting.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that... And you know, Graham was fired up by that, and because there was this kind of extraordinary connection between them, and they sort of just got one another, I think, from the word go, and there was a part of Graham that trusted Elton, and thought, well, you know, he's weird, he looks weird, and he may be nuts and all the rest of it, but he's passionate, and Graham was passionate, so, you know, that was one of the things they shared, and they were both romantics. And you know, you mentioned Wrexham, the Welcome to Wrexham earlier, you know, that owning and running a kind of lowly football club, I mean, you've got to be a romantic to want to do that, because it's, you know, it's Roy of the Rovers stuff, isn't it? And that was, again, that was another of the things that Elton and Graham had in common.
But his job when he got there, he knew it was a big job. Maybe he didn't realise how big it was. I loved the piece about the scouting system. We do have a scout who goes to local clubs and watches players, but he hasn't been that often. Why is that? Well, he's 94.
Yeah.
And the training kit was a bag of kit lobbed into the middle of the dressing room. It was pick your own up. It's washed once a week. I mean, this really is at the bottom end here. He is starting right in the depths.
Yeah, and I remember going to Watford actually in the late 70s, and I don't think it was necessarily any worse than other fourth division clubs, but you know, God, it was rank. And you know, the pitch was a mud bath, and you know, there was the kind of corrugated iron, the stand with the corrugated iron roof, and mushrooms were reputed to grow on the walls of the men's toilet. Yeah, needless to say, there was no women's toilet because there was absolutely no provision made for women at all. So yeah, it was primitive in the extreme.
He loved, Elton loved Graham Taylor's bluntness about anything. If you asked him a question, he would get a blunt answer. And again, here, the two of them had this relationship where Graham felt he was quite able within his rights to say, if you don't sort something out, I'm off. And one of those came when he knocked on the door. And again, this is hilarious because there is a dog track there. We know there's a greyhound track. The physio's door shut. He knocks on the door, walks straight in, and on the physio's table is a greyhound being treated.
Yeah. Because the greyhound had pulled a muscle or something, so the physio was giving it a massage, and Graham just, you know, not untypically, blew his top, and basically said to Elton, you know, either the dogs go or I do. And Elton immediately said, right, okay, the dogs go. And off they went. But, you know, so I suppose that counted as an improvement of sorts. But, yeah.
What do you think, Elton, Graham Taylor would have thought on day one when he's there and he's down pitch side and he looks to his left and he sees Elton in his 6-inch heels tottering down the pitch side to take his position sat on the bench?
Well, outright horror, because he thought it was completely inappropriate behaviour.
You were talking about Elton craving the approval of Graham Taylor, who was, when he found it, he was appalled at the drink and drug where he waited. Elton was in the room one day, walked in with a bottle of brandy, slapped it down on the table and said, there you go. That's what you have for breakfast, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was a really critical moment for Elton because he was in a bad state by this point. He was drinking far too much. He was taking lots of cocaine. And as he said, you know, no, he wouldn't have taken it from anybody else because he was essentially surrounded by sycophants and no one would have dared talk to him like that. But, you know, Graham, who was a very plain speaking man, was kind of uncowed by him and also, you know, cared deeply about him by this stage and could see what he was doing to himself.
His wife, by the way.
Yeah, and so could reach his wife.
She was the one that suggested inviting him around for supper, and it became something of a, well, not necessarily regular, but it's something that happens on more than one occasion where they come, they have dinner, they all wash up, and then they end up playing games.
Yeah, and because, you know, it was Rita who worked out that what Elton needed above all was a sense of normality. And, you know, he didn't get it anywhere else in his life. And then when Graham slammed this bottle of brandy down on the table in front of him, you know, Elton was humiliated. I mean, he said he just sat there with his head bowed and he didn't know what to say. And he sort of slunk off afterwards and he went back to his home in Windsor. And, you know, he's never been in any doubt that essentially by doing that, Graham saved his life and he set him on the road to recovery. Now, it was quite a long and bumpy road. I mean, he didn't actually go into rehab until 1990. But without that, and this had happened, this probably happened in, I can't remember, sort of 81 or something like this. But he was absolutely adamant that it would never have happened at all if it hadn't been for Graham essentially losing his rag. Sorry?
I was going to say, I mean, Elton was a great chairman. I mean, again, there are moments in the book where if he couldn't attend a meeting, he would fly the board to wherever he was.
His attitude towards that something is that if he's going to commit to it, he will do it wholeheartedly. He really does not do things by halves. So, you know, his devotion to Watford and his obsession with Watford never faltered. And you know, both he and Graham felt that they were on this astonishing adventure. And so it proved.
There is a gentleman in here who plays a role in this story called Mike Vince, who I actually know. This is in the time, again, back in the 80s, where, you know, I mean, if you were in Europe or you were away, you simply had no way of knowing how things happened, how things panned out, whether the results or anything else. Newspapers were days old. So he had this brilliant idea. Mike Vince used to work on hospital radio doing the commentary, and Elton would phone and be patched through so that he could listen on the telephone to the commentary live, wherever he was in the world.
Yeah, so Mike Vince was in the weird position of having an audience which was comprised of, you know, maximum a few hundred people lying recumbent in their hospital beds, in the hospital which is next to Vicarage Road, incidentally. And, you know, Elton, a global superstar. But it kind of, it fulfilled quite an important function, I think, because, it, you know, it was like a sort of umbilical cord that kept him tethered to Watford, wherever he was in the world. And yes, his phone bills were ruinously expensive, but he wasn't remotely fussed about that. And the most important thing is he was able to keep in touch, which he did for, you know, year after year. And, you know, this was... we're talking what a good 20 years before the internet. So as you say, it was the only way of doing it.
Everybody's heard a story of a cab driver who said, "Here, mate, I know you're the manager of a football club. I'll tell you what, I've seen this great kid. He's amazing. You've got to get down to see them at XYZ Club FC." But that is actually what happened, wasn't it? When he was told about a prodigious talent at playing at Sudbury Court in North London.
Yeah, so basically, Graham came back and told Bertie Mee, ex-manager of Arsenal, who had volunteered to help out at Watford and became an absolutely sort of indispensable part of the team. And Bertie Mee would go off and see these purportedly promising youngsters, who, as you say, you know, cab drivers were constantly telling them about. He went to see this guy, name of John Barnes, and he thought, "Oh my God, this guy's the real deal." And Watford ended up signing him, and they couldn't, because Sudbury Town were amateurs, so they couldn't pay them any money, so they gave them a new set of kit as a kind of transfer fee. And so both parties were happy, and John Barnes went to Watford, and that was, you know, that was one of the absolutely critical things that took Watford, who by this, you know, there was a danger that they would be kind of becalmed in Division Two as it then was, and that they might not have quite the class to get up and hold their own in Division One, and yet, you know, pretty much from the word that go that, you know, John Barnes joined them, he helped hoist them up into another league.
When you were writing this book, fans always have great memories of particular games. Is Watford Southampton one of the greatest games for Watford fans? The 4-0 down and then coming back to win 7-5.
Yeah, I think unquestionably. But when I, before I started writing the book, I thought very naively that I had this idea that I would sort of home in on a number of absolutely key games, and I thought, well, it's not going to be that difficult to kind of, as it were, reanimate these games and make them as vivid and exciting as possible. But actually, it turned out to be incredibly difficult because No national press covered any Watford games, and there was no television. And you know, Watford was lucky in that they had very good fanzines, and a lot of their supporters did actually write very well about particular games. But probably the most critical thing was that there was a guy called Oliver Phillips, who was the football correspondent of the Watford Observer, who was a terrific football correspondent, very, very passionate, wildly partisan, but wrote in extremely vivid and dramatic way about these games. And I went to see him in France, where he'd moved to France, and he could not have been more helpful. And very sadly, he died before the book came out. But, you know, I could not in any way have done it without him.
Just a couple of things before we conclude. Mm. And they're both Elton related. And this almost brings a tear to your eye, this moment. I mean, his father had a heart attack and everything else. And there have been attempts by Elton to help with his medical bills, etc., which were always batted away. But they did agree to meet before a game against Liverpool. They would meet for lunch at the Adelphi in town, and they went and sat in the director's box. But the really poignant moment here is when they get back into his car at the end of the day, they drop him off at the station, and the last time he ever sees his father is this figure walking into the distance, into the train station. He doesn't turn back, doesn't look at him, and that's it. And that's the last contact he ever had with him.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think it's a sort of enduring mystery to Elton in a way, because his father, as you say, remarried and had more children. And by all accounts, was a devoted father, and was even quite demonstrative to his new family, Elton. And so, you know, you have this incredibly poignant scene of somebody who is kind of pretty much being worshipped by a large chunk of the world, and yet he just can't get approval from the one person that he really wants it from. And, you know, they've sat and had lunch, and Elton was really, really hoping that this would be a rapprochement between the two of them. And yet he found they just had nothing to talk about at all. And he felt his father's eyes kind of, you know, giving him the once over, and this air of disapproval settling on his father's shoulders. And he just realized, you know, it's never going to happen. And I've just got to go through life and stop hoping that it is going to happen.
And they eventually obviously get to Division One, 82, 83. They end up second in Division One. And it is hard to quantify this story. Graham Taylor spent under £1 million to actually get into the first division. And of course, we then knew that they were going to make the FA Cup final as well. Mm. Is this football's greatest story? I mean, is there anybody that's ever got anywhere close to replicating what they have done here?
No, not really. I mean, Wimbledon, I suppose, is probably the closest example. But to me, you know, what makes this such a great story is the personal relationship between Elton and Graham at the heart of it. And the fact that, you know, Graham had this kind of pathological dislike of spending Elton's money. So the last thing he was going to do was splash it about. And so they really did achieve this remarkable thing with very, very, very scant resources. And, you know, it's never been done before or since. And I've, you know, it's impossible to imagine it ever will happen again. And it was, you know, it is a kind of fairy tale of its time. And yet, you know, one of the things that makes it, to my mind, so kind of resonant is that it's a fairy tale set against this very grim backdrop of life in England in the late 70s, early 80s, where, as you say, you know, racism was absolutely widespread. So was homophobia. So it's got this, you know, I hope it's a heartwarming story. And yet it's a heartwarming story with, I also hope, a bit of bite to it as well.
What a great story that was. Leaves you perhaps reappraising as well how you feel about Graham Taylor, and maybe wishing that the times where a realisable dream could still come true in football, as opposed to the rather stark reality of today. Watford Forever, then, is out now. And that just about wraps it up, then, for this edition and for 2023. Hope you've enjoyed the series throughout the course of the year. And remember, you can listen to every previous edition of the show on the website, www.talkingsportsbooks.com, or via any streaming provider. Thanks once again to our sponsors, primepodcast.co.uk. And that's it. I'll be back in the new year. Until then, from me, Tim Capel. Bye-bye for now.